Hello and welcome to Everything In Between, the podcast where a dad and daughter duo delve deep into topics ranging from true crime to paranormal occurrences to urban legends and, well, everything in between. I'm Emma.
I'm the dad.
That's Anish. And it's now May, so all the things we were talking about before are now starting to come out.
That's true. We're recording on a Monday. It's actually May the 4th.
May the 4th be with you.
And we're recording in our basement for the first time in a long time, I guess.
First time since, like, I think the last time we were down here, we used that one microphone, like the Rode.
Yeah, Rode that would microphone. Have been. Did we do others? I think we did a couple. Until we got this equipment, we were there. But we've been.
I think it was the Vengeful Spirits episode.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like two-parter we did down here.
I think Krisha just took over my computer, so we had to come down here because he's really loud when he's gaming. But we're in day 52 of the quarantine. Yeah. But as you were saying, new things have come out because of May and
literally in some cases.
That's true.
We watched the half of it, which ended up being a movie, which I thought was a TV show for the longest time. I don't know why I thought, but it was so good.
It is great.
It had everything. I loved it so much.
I feel like we always overhype everything, so
I know
you
actually it's terrible. You should watch it to
low
make fun of it.
Don't
go into it thinking anything good. But no, that was enjoyable.
That's on Netflix if you don't know. And the writing, the acting, it's just really, really well done. And it's not, I wouldn't say it's overly predictable.
Yeah.
I think it's good.
What I thought was going to happen didn't happen. So
it's just a
kind of like a sweet movie.
Yeah. And I like the main character. I think she's going to, she'll go on to hopefully bigger and better. Well, I should say better because this was great, but more because I'd like to see a lot more.
It was really good. And then the TV show Hollywood also came out on Netflix, which I started watching, and it is very in your face. And I really enjoy it because I really like the vintage type thing and like old Hollywood, but it is very intense.
It's an alternate telling, right, of Hollywood, right?
It's like it takes some liberties.
Yeah, no, I knew that, but I know some of that stuff's really is based on true stuff.
Oh yeah, that. Yeah, but it's definitely it's a lot. I like it. I don't know. I didn't think I would like it because I don't think I really. Ryan Murphy, didn't he do Glee or something?
He's done a lot. He's done American Horror.
Yeah, see, I didn't really like American Horror Story that much.
Yeah, definitely Glee. And then
I did not like Glee.
And there's another one that was, I can't remember if it was a movie or not. It was about high school election for student council.
The Politician?
Yes.
That's a TV show. I haven't seen that.
I think he also is behind that, too.
And then he did the movie you watched, right, with Mom? A Secret Love, didn't he do that?
I think he produced it. Yes. But that was a good, that it's a really interesting documentary. And it's not just about the couple, but the family. I mean, the one thing I will say, and maybe it's probably actually more in your Hollywood than anything, but they spend a little bit of time on the 50s. Well, I know Hollywood takes place earlier, but the 50s and what it meant if you, at least in Illinois, if you were caught, lesbian or gay, what could happen? And it was insane.
Yeah, I put that on my list the other day because it looked really interesting.
So in a way it would have been, more... Not that actually it would have made the documentary completely different, but it's not. I don't know how to categorize it. It's a really well done documentary, but it's not what I expected about the couple, because it's about this, their relationship, and it's a really interesting relationship. I mean, they love each other, but it's weird. Hmm. So yeah, so that was, I really did like that.
Yeah. And then you also had us watch The Full Monty.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
That was like a couple nights ago, I think.
I can't remember when.
Which was very entertaining, especially watching Christian squirm because he was so uncomfortable.
Which I don't understand why, but yeah, I don't know. That was, I will say that, and I'm glad you guys were good sports, because I didn't realize how dated it was when I was watching it, because I was kind of like, when it came out, it was something completely different. I think it was in the 90s or something. And
I mean, it seemed pretty progressive.
Well, I think the subject matter is, but
in some of the terms that they use it are not.
Well, it's not even that. I was cringing at the acting. Like, I was actually, because when I saw it, I was like, this is, I mean, I love that movie. And then as I was watching, I'm like, oh my God, they're not good. Like, he's not good. And there's a lot of famous people in it who went on to do other things. So
yeah, I couldn't, I couldn't not see the main character as, like, not being Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah, yeah. No. And he's done, I mean, I know you don't, we've talked about some other movies, but he's done a lot, and he's can play it all. I mean, I know Rumpelstiltskin is kind of neutral, chaotic. He's played really bad, dark characters. But even the one guy who is in the relationship, who's worried about his wife maybe cheating on him, and then she thinks that guy has been in a bunch of stuff too. He was in A Knight's Tale. I can't remember the actor's name.
Oh, I feel like I don't remember A Knight's Tale very well. I feel like we should probably watch it again.
But I love the soundtrack, and I love the last scene. Is just,
yes, the last
you know, the last scene of the movie is great.
Yeah, I really liked it. I thought it was very funny.
Yeah, but I do think if you haven't seen it, I feel like it's slightly generational. So for like your generation, I think you might get a little camp out of it and be like, yeah, yeah. But for us who had maybe seen it before, if you watch it again, you'll be like, I did. At some point, I was like, and it took a long time to get going. I didn't realize it was that long.
I was a little iffy on it at first.
Yeah, no, I was too, after seeing it again, I'm like, wait, what's going on? So, but anyway, it's great soundtrack, funny movie. I can't remember if it's loosely based on something true. I feel like it was, but I don't know.
That's very funny. Yeah. It was a very good thing. I enjoyed it. And also, I've been doing, with my friends, we've been doing a lot of like bad movie nights, which I think I mentioned before. But mostly now we're focusing on really bad like Netflix movies that have... oh my God, what's his name? Noah Centineo, I think, in it.
I don't know who that is.
I don't think you watched anything with him in it, but he was Peter Kavinsky in To All the Boys I've Loved Before.
I haven't seen that either, so.
I know, but I just figured.
Okay.
Just to, yeah. Anyway. So these
are bad movies that must have happened in the last year?
Oh yeah. So our theory, there's a bunch. It's so weird.
That he's in?
Yeah. We think that, okay, he kind of like blew up a lot after that movie came out. Everyone was like thirsting after him, right? And so our theory is that Netflix just like stuck him in a bunch of movies that they just had lying around, just to like, they basically just had him at gunpoint. Just
no, it doesn't, these movies. The way Netflix, I remember, they're not, even if it's a Netflix original, it just means that they bought the rights.
That's
so
true.
That's,
but
all
I feel like
they didn't produce a bunch of these films.
That's
and
true.
Spend the money. A lot of them, there's a few Netflix originals that I can't remember. They have different terms. Maybe it's when they say it's a Netflix film or Netflix show versus a Netflix original.
They're originals.
All of these were originals.
I don't remember. I didn't look very closely.
Right, let's get our facts.
The point is, they're so awful. And the one I think is the worst one we've watched so far. It's called SPF 18.
Okay, you can stop.
But
already.
Here's the thing.
You can stop.
Here's
already.
The thing.
Oh,
I'm not
God.
Even gonna go into how bad it is, because it was really terrible. I recommend watching it though. It's so funny how horrible it is. But the thing is, there are a lot of famous people in it. Keanu Reeves is in it. And so is Molly Ringwald and Goldie Hawn. And there's another person who I can't remember who's in it. And they're
like in it, or are they just part of the show? Like, they make cameos.
It's for some of them, it's cameos, but Molly Ringwald is like a character.
Okay, well, she really hasn't done anything since the John Hughes film, so let's.
But I thought it was kind of funny that Keanu Reeves was in it. But basically, like, the plot, there is not really a plot, but they end up at Keanu Reeves' beach house because they're
house-sitting. Like,
it's just like, what?
What was the other movie that we watched?
What?
With Ali Wong? Oh my God. The one about when he's her boyfriend. Keanu Reeves is her boyfriend.
Oh, Always Be My Maybe?
Yeah. So, I mean, there must be, he was just,
I don't know, maybe, I think it was very funny that he just sort of like popped in.
But again, in Always Be My Maybe, there's that whole scene in his house.
Oh my God, yeah.
Oh my God.
I forgot about that. But the point is, it was such a terrible movie and we were laughing so hard over it because there's no continuity, there's no plot. There's like a whole dream sequence that's animated in like 8-bit. It's so bad. But definitely watch it if you want to laugh, because we were definitely laughing.
I think you're talking to two different audiences right now.
That's okay. Maybe if you get a certain level of bored during quarantine, that's what you go do. But yeah, that's all I had to say about that.
Okay.
So I think that's all. We can jump into the stories.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, these weeks, days, they're going slower and slower, I feel.
Slower and faster at the same time.
I
feel like March lasted years and April lasted like 2 minutes.
No, that is actually really true. All right. Yeah. Let's get into it.
Yeah. Cool. So, originally, I was supposed to be doing a paranormal episode this week, since last week I did a true crime episode, but somebody here seemed to forget that.
Just get on with your story, all right?
But luckily, the topic I chose kind of doubles as a true crime-y kind of thing.
So it's an in-between.
Yeah, kind all of. Right. So I'm doing an in-between, and apparently you're also doing a paranormal one.
You'll hear it.
Okay, lovely. So my sources for this week, I used a lot of different Wikipedia pages. I used the Smithsonian Magazine, The Guardian, Historic UK, History Extra, and The New Yorker.
Okay.
So, I already in my bullets, I said today I'm going to do something a little bit different.
We'll see then.
So it worked out perfectly.
So it was planned perfectly. I mean, there's exactly. Not a worry here.
So I'm covering kind of more of a broader topic, then I'm going to zoom in on a couple stories from it.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk about the spiritualist movement.
Oh, okay.
So that was sort
of
like...
Yeah, this should be interesting because it really is. Yeah, all right.
It was an interesting time. And I had to cut one of the stories out because it was getting long. But basically, it sort of started in like the late 1800s and then sort of tapered off in like the 1920s.
Okay.
So that's sort of the time period I'm focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
So it also mostly is popular in like the US and UK, or at least that's where more of the stories have come from. So what really was becoming popular at this time were like seances and mediums and clairvoyance. And just to clear up, basically a clairvoyant is someone who claims to have a supernatural ability to perceive events in the future or beyond normal sensory contact. And a medium is someone who claims to be in contact with the spirits of the dead and to communicate between the dead and the living.
So one feels and one...
talks, kind
yeah.
of? Yeah.
Okay.
And I believe you could be a clairvoyant and a medium.
Yeah, so. I can't believe that.
Yeah, so seances of different shapes and sizes. So the image that I'm sure you have of people sitting around a table with candles and like holding hands and chanting isn't the only like kind of way they were doing it, which I'll get into. But many people would find fame by showing off their ability to contact the dead. And so they would produce like proof. In some versions, that would be like through knocking or being like possessed or actually producing an apparition or ectoplasm. An ectoplasm is a supernatural viscous not viscous, but viscous.
No, viscous, yeah.
Never heard of that word before.
Really?
Never.
Huh.
Huh. Anyway, substance that is supposed to exude from the body of a medium.
Think of oil.
Ew.
That's, you know.
I always thought of it as kind of like slime.
Well, like, I mean.
More chunky.
Oil.
Like molasses, I guess, is what I was thinking.
Yeah, I would think, I think of it as, and I'm not thinking you're cooking oil, I'm thinking of car oil, that kind of, it's a little bit
like thicker. Dark.
Yeah, it's thick and, well, it can be clear. It's just that, it's definitely thick. Molasses is,
I just think of Ghostbusters.
Yeah, but again, that was much more of a, yeah, it's goopy.
Goopy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it exudes from the body of a medium during a spiritualistic trance. And can form, it's like the material for the manifestation of spirits.
Okay. If you remind me, because there's a movie we're going to watch that I've been waiting for that talks about ectoplasm and all these things you're saying.
What movie?
Well, keep going. I'll talk to the end. What?
You're going to forget.
No, I don't. I've shown you the trailer like 6 times and
you
it's finally rentable.
You know that I have a very bad memory.
Okay.
Anyway, so the first players in this movement I'm going to talk about are the Fox sisters.
Yeah.
We
talked about them. I talked about them in something I can't remember. I mean, they weren't not a big part, but yeah, I think when I did the Ouija board and everything, when I did my Ouija board story.
Probably, yeah. But they're probably like the most well-known in relation to this movement because they're believed to have started it.
Yeah.
So they basically on March 31st, 1848 is the official like start date of the movement. And on that day, Kate and Margaret Fox, by the way, they also had a third like sister, but I don't mention her at all in here.
I thought that was like that they ended up moving and it was kind of a cousin, but they called themselves sisters.
I didn't really look into her that much because I was focusing more on them, but, I don't think she was too involved. I think she like helped them out a little bit, but she wasn't like saying that she was a medium herself.
No, I think she helped out in the beginning and then she dropped out when they started traveling the country.
Yeah. So Kate and Margaret Fox, they claimed to have made contact with the spirit, quote, of a murdered peddler whose body had been found in the house.
Right.
In their house. So there wasn't any record of this happening, of like any peddler being murdered.
Yep.
But the public was entranced with the story, especially when the sisters were able to demonstrate that the ghost was communicating with them via like knocking or rapping.
Yep. Yep.
So the Fox sisters sort of shot to fame after that, because they were sort of holding, sort of like seances where they would talk to ghosts via these like knocking noises. They came up with like a code to ask questions like yes or no and stuff like that. And people were fascinated by their abilities. So they would conduct public seances. I think they kind of started out in New York, where they would conduct like these public seances that would attract lots of people and allow people to watch and listen in awe as these spirits seemingly knocked back and forth with the girls.
Right, right.
So on that night when the sisters were interacting with the spirit, they asked it like what the ages of the sisters were, and it knocked back like the amount of years or whatever. And that sort of proved, I guess, that it was...
They were young, too, because, I mean, if they were, like, 28 or 30, it'd have been a long time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think they were kind of young.
I think they were in their teens.
Yes, I believe so, because I think also they believed their house was haunted, or their mother believed their house was haunted, because she would hear, like, weird noises up in the attic. And later, it got revealed that it was actually the sisters, like, with an apple on a string that were just, like, bonking the apple around, and it made such a unique sound that their mother just didn't think it was them, and was like scared to death.
And they just kept going.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they just brought it bigger. So the girls named the spirit Mr. Splitfoot, which is one of Satan's nicknames.
Oh, did not know that.
Lovely. Yeah. Fun fact.
It makes sense, I guess, if they have hoofed.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was thinking like cloven hooves. Yeah. And then it wasn't until later that the spirit claimed to be the murdered peddler, a man named Charles B. Rosna.
Okay.
But there was no Charles B. Rosna on record anywhere.
All right.
So, yeah. I think it's more likely that it was Mr. Splitfoot. So, of course, the sisters were met with skeptics at, like, every step of their career. Most people believed that the rapping actually came from the ladies' creaking joints, which, honestly, every morning when I get out of bed, it's like a whole symphony coming from my bones. So it's not too far-fetched. Yeah, so many of these people believed that they were, like, hiding some kind of device under their long dresses that would they would like brush against like a wooden table leg or something and it would make a sound.
Right.
And then some people were like, oh, they're just cracking their bones or whatever. And one time someone was testing them by having them put like a cushion under their feet while they were conducting a seance.
Yep.
And no knocking happened at all.
Huh.
So, I mean, that kind of proves it, honestly. So in 1857, somehow all of this like stuff that's proving them wrong is just not really damaging their career.
Gotcha.
So in 1857, the girls attempted to win a $500, which would be about $14,000 today.
Okay.
$500 prize from the Boston Courier, which was offered to anyone who could prove they had a paranormal ability.
All right.
The sisters were evaluated by a committee of three Harvard professors, but they failed the test.
Shocking.
Yeah. The professors determined that they were making the movements through their bones and feet.
Okay.
So. This apparently didn't stop them either, because they just kept going with their
seances. Oh, again, news had to get out, so
that's true.
There was no easy way.
Yeah. But then in 1888, the sisters confessed that their methods had been fraudulent. By this time, Kate and Margaret had both become very heavy drinkers, and they often would, like, quarrel among themselves, and they were having arguments, and, you know, the band was breaking up.
It's like 40 years, right? 40 years later.
Yeah.
So they'd been doing it for a while, so yeah.
A very long time. And they agreed to do an exclusive interview explaining how they'd faked their seances if they were each paid, or maybe it was jointly paid, $1,500.
Okay.
Which is about $43,000 today.
All right.
So they did their interview. And I believe, like, shortly after this confession, Margaret tried to, like, recant it and be like, actually, never mind. It was all real.
Jeez.
But by that point, it was too late. Like, their reputation had been tarnished. And then a little bit after that, the sisters became very religious and convinced that spiritualism was, like, sacrilegious.
Gotcha.
And bad. And on October 9th, 1888, so the same year, Kate Fox was quoted saying, quote, I regard spiritualism as one of the great curses that the world has ever known.
If so, I can't have it, no one can.
Yeah, complete turnaround.
Right.
So Margaret and Kate died shortly after this, like a couple years, like within 5 years. According to Wikipedia, quote, in abject poverty. So despite their admissions as being frauds, the spiritualist movement forged on as a whole, gaining strength by the day.
Right, because I think still at that time, if you were, like, religions opened up, welcomed it with open arms, right? Because mm-hmm. it was a way to make what they believe more real, that all this is, yeah.
Yeah. So
we did talk about it, because I don't think spiritualism actually changed till a lot later,
mm-hmm.
right?
And it's still around today.
Well, yeah, but I mean that it had that connotation of you're playing with darkness.
Right. Yeah. A lot of it was, I get into this a little bit later with like the last person I cover, but during this time, it was like the Civil War and World War One, and it even went into like World War Two, and people were like losing loved ones, and they really wanted to like get in contact with them. And
right.
So that was a big like spark. And I'm not going to talk about it here, but because this was... This specific thing was covered on And That's Why We Drink, but Houdini was very involved.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was such a skeptic, and he would, like, go around.
Yeah, he and Arthur Conan Doyle had a big...
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that.
So I don't talk about that here, but that was a big thing. A lot of famous people were going around, like, disproving or, like, trying to prove that it was all real. So the next person I'm going to talk about is Helen Duncan, who was the last person to be imprisoned under the British Witchcraft Act of 1735.
Huh.
So Helen was born on November 25th, 1897, in Callander, Perthshire, Scotland.
Okay.
At school, she, quote, alarmed her fellow pupils with her dire prophecies and hysterical behavior, which means that we totally would have been best friends. So in 1916, she married a cabinet maker named Henry Duncan, who was very supportive of her supernatural abilities that she was discovering. And by 1926, Helen was working as a clairvoyant and medium, offering seances where she claimed to be able to summon the deceased by, quote, emitting ectoplasm from her mouth. So that gave her some fame.
There you go.
And of course, soon the skeptics came.
Yeah.
As they always do. So in 1928, photographer Harvey Meerkath came to one of Helen's seances. And she's getting a lot of popularity, like, really fast. So he took several flash photographs of the medium and the spirits that she was materializing.
Right.
So she would do this thing, like, she would have the ectoplasm, and she also, like, would sometimes make apparitions appear.
Okay.
So Helen claimed to have a spirit guide named Peggy, who was also photographed by Metcalf. And when the photos were developed, it was discovered that these spirits were actually things like dolls made from paper mache and old sheets.
Okay.
With, like, faces drawn on.
Gotcha.
Also, the ectoplasm that Helen was spewing during her seances was revealed to be made from cheesecloth, paper mixed with egg whites, and toilet paper. Like, okay. All of that just mixed together.
Right. So, just a science project or school project. Art class.
Yes. So Helen would swallow that concoction.
Yeah.
And then make herself, like, regurgitate it during the seance. Oh,
wonderful.
So lovely. But again, her career is still going strong. In 1931, the London Spiritualist Alliance examined Helen's abilities, giving her a tablet of methylene blue before one of her seances. And as a result, no ectoplasm appeared.
Okay.
So I tried looking it up, and I don't really know what it is still, but I assume it, like, calms your stomach maybe, or, like, keeps you from throwing up. I guess,
yeah, must have.
I don't know, but she wasn't able to produce the ectoplasm. And then a piece of the ectoplasm, in quotes, was saved after one of her sessions.
Oh, God.
So gross. And sent to our favorite skeptic, Harry Price. if you remember him, he was in my Borley Rectory story. But he is very important during, like, all the spiritualist, stuff. He appears sort of in, like, the next part that I'm going to talk about, but anyway, he's a key player, kind of. So he eagerly analyzed this, sample of ectoplasm, and found that it was egg whites mixed with chemicals, and was like, oh, darn, it's not ghosts.
Right.
So Price then proceeded to pay Helen £50 to perform some test seances for him.
Okay.
And he suspected already that she was swallowing and then regurgitating her ectoplasm because she, quote, reacted violently at attempts to x-ray her.
I think he's done that before too, right? There was a couple of people he's tried x-ray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's his account from this, like, that he wrote down, that I just found so funny that I feel like I had to read it out. So, quote, at the conclusion of the fourth seance, we led the medium to the settee and called for the apparatus. At the sight of it, this being the x-ray, the lady promptly went into a trance. She recovered, but refused to be x-rayed. Her husband went up to her and told her it was painless. She jumped up and gave him a smashing blow to the face, which sent him reeling.
Oh, my God.
Then she went for Dr. William Brown, who was present. He dodged the blow.
Jeez.
Mrs. Duncan, without the slightest warning, dashed out into the street, had an attack of hysteria, and began to tear her seance garment to pieces. She clutched the railings and screamed and screamed. Her husband tried to pacify her. It was useless.
Jeez.
So, eventually, they did manage to get her back to the lab. And when that happened, when they did finally x-ray her, there was nothing there. And so he says that he was convinced that when her husband was, like, trying to comfort her in the street, she had handed off the ectoplasm to him, or like, I guess, thrown it up and given to him and whatever, so that she would be clean for the x-ray.
Right.
So I believe during one of the seances when she did regurgitate the ectoplasm, someone managed to like cut some of it before she could like yank herself away. So they managed to get another sample.
Okay.
And so they analyzed it and it turned out to be that eggy mixture again. Yeah. So Price, in response to that, wrote, quote, "Could anything be more infantile than a group of grown-up men wasting time, money, and energy on the antics of a fat female crook?"
Oh, jeez.
She's a little bit rude.
Yeah, it is kind of rude.
But, yikes. Just yikes.
There you go.
So all of this was publicized.
Yep.
But for some reason, Helen still got business.
Well, if you want to believe, you're going to believe. It's no different than going to, you know, get your palms read and stuff.
That's true. Very true. So during one seance on January 6th, 1933, she called forth her spirit guide, Peggy. And one of the people at the seance jumped up and grabbed Peggy, and turned on the lights, and revealing that it was actually a doll, made from a stockinette undervest.
Okay.
Again, I guess it didn't really damage her career. And then during World War II, Helen held a like public seance by like the port of wherever she was. I don't know at the time. But she claimed to have seen the spirit of a sailor telling her that a ship called the HMS Barham had sunk.
Okay.
And this was true.
Okay.
However, it was classified information.
Oh, boy. So somebody got in trouble.
So the Navy took an interest in her. And so they were like they started observing some of her seances.
Right.
And then during one of these seances, there was a Navy lieutenant present, and a figure in white cloth appeared, and this figure claimed to be the dead aunt of this lieutenant. However, he didn't have a dead aunt.
Okay.
So he was very enraged. And then during another seance that he attended, a figure claimed to be his sister. But then he informed this figure that his sister was alive and well. So that didn't go very well for him. But he was very disgusted and enraged by this. So he reported the seance to police. And Helen was arrested on January 19th, 1944 during a different seance. When another white figure made an appearance. And I believe it actually happened during the seance. Police like came in. I would think they tackled the figure, which ended up being Helen herself. Like, in a sheet.
Ah, bro.
So she was arrested. Officials figured that Helen had found out about the sinking through gossip because, like, letters of condolence had been sent to the families of the sailors.
Right.
But they were like, keep this under wraps. But who actually does that, you know?
Right.
So she was officially arrested under the British Witchcraft Act for fraudulent spiritual activity. And Helen was found guilty, obviously, and sent to prison for 9 months.
Okay.
The trial itself actually caused a lot of outrage because people were angry that there was still a witchcraft act.
It just should have been for fraud, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but I mean, later the witchcraft act itself was repealed, making her like the last person to be imprisoned under it. And then upon release, Helen promised not to conduct any more seances, but then she was arrested again in 1956 for one. And then soon after that, she died at her home in Edinburgh. So that's Helen Duncan. And then the last thing I want to cover is spirit photography, which I don't know if you know about that, but it is quite a doozy. And this is another thing that Harry Price kind of appeared in. I'm going to be talking about the founder of spirit photography, but there was another famous guy who was sort of debunked by Harry Price. So.
Gotcha.
So soon after the spiritualist movement started, the concept of spirit photography became popular. It was first used by William H. Mumler in the 1860s, and he actually discovered it by mistake. So Mumler was working in Boston at the time, and he was employed as a jewelry engraver.
Okay.
He noticed in a photograph that he took of himself, hashtag selfie, that there was a second person. And he thought that it looked a lot like a cousin of his, a cousin that had been dead for 12 years.
Wow.
So like I was saying, spiritualism was getting more and more popular, and this gave Mumler the idea to start his like spirit photography business.
Okay.
So people would come in, he'd take their portrait, and then when the photos were developed, there would be like a dead loved one standing next to them.
All the time or just...
All the time.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you were mourning the loss of a loved one, you would come in, you'd be like, let's have a portrait. And then someone would be like standing next to you that was your loved one.
Okay.
So he started gaining a lot of attention from these photographs. And he started doing it full time, so he's no longer a jewelry engraver.
But when he did his first one, he faked it the first one then? Or he realized, oh, I can do this?
He realized that he could do it. Because it was... Okay. So about this at the end, but no, it was like a double exposure
kind of thing. I understand that part. I just was trying to figure out like the way you said it. He took a picture and then he's like, oh, he saw his cousin. I mean, it would look like him because...
Yeah, exactly.
He's related, so I didn't understand the part of the leap of, oh, look what I can do, now let's do this versus...
I was going to hide the part that it's a fraud until the end.
Fair enough.
But, you know, that's fine. It was a fraud. But, yeah, he thought it kind of looked like his cousin, and he realized that he, like, kind of messed up the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he was like, wait, I can just, like, make a business out of this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. So he eventually moved to New York City, where he continued his practice with a larger audience.
Of course.
Yeah.
More money.
Of course. And William's wife, Hannah Mumler, was also a practicing medium.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
They're just meant for each other.
Exactly. So she was famous for her psychic healing abilities.
Great. So, gotcha.
Yeah. So on the side, she would help him with his business as well.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, William faced a lot of skeptics. Numerous photography experts analyzed his photos, but at the time they couldn't find any evidence that they were faked. So they were like, we're watching you, but we can't prove it yet. And so, like I was saying earlier, a big reason that William was really popular during this time was because the Civil War had just ended.
Right.
And a lot of people were like mourning their loved ones
right.
and wanted their photos taken. So sometime around 1869, though some sources say it was 1872,
mm-hmm.
A widow came to his shop and asked if she could have her photo taken to see if her husband would show up. So William took the photo and her husband did show up. However, this was no regular couple. The woman was Mary Todd Lincoln and her husband was Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed up in the photo and all that. So that became very, very famous, that photo. And even though it was not a real photo and he had just manipulated it, it's very famous. And to this day, people are like, oh, have you heard about this? His ghost being in... Yeah, anyway. So in April of 1869, William was arrested for fraud.
Shocking.
Very shocking. One of the major critics of his photos was P.T. Barnum.
Wow.
Yeah, a.k.a. Hugh Jackman.
Was he getting angry?
He was
taking away business from him or something?
No, he was angry. I have a quote from him in a second. But he hired a guy named Abraham Bogardus to doctor photos in the same way that he thought William was doing it to prove that it was easily faked.
Sure.
He was able to recreate it. And this was used as proof in William's trial that his photos were fakes.
Okay.
And Barnum even testified against William.
Okay.
Like, he was so against him. And previously he had said, I think the big reason is because, quote, Mumler was taking advantage of people whose judgment was clouded by grief.
Yeah, fair. That's usually how they do it.
Yeah, exactly. So he was, like, against it.
Yeah.
He was,
got it.
This guy's going down, you know? So that... evidence against William was the photograph that was doctored, as well as a photo that William had taken himself, where the spirits in the picture were actually people that were alive. So, you know, it didn't make sense that they could have been in the picture right. as ghosts. William actually ended up being acquitted because the jury didn't think that there was proof that all of the photos were fakes. So even though he was acquitted, his career was completely ruined, and he ended up dying in poverty, like the Fox sisters. So his photos were definitely not real. And I was, as I said, I was gonna, you know, hide the fraud bit, but he used like a double exposure for his first photo, and that kind of like inspired him.
Yeah. No. Then he.
Yeah.
Fine-tuned his craft.
Yeah, he ended up after his spear photography thing was over, he did like regular photography. And he invented like this wood cutting method thing. I didn't write it down, but it became called, it was like the Mumler method or something like that. That was used for a while and became popular. But spiritualism itself thrived during late 1800s, early 1900s, before kind of tapering off. But it is still practiced by a minority of people today. And although I did cover a bunch of frauds, we can't assume that every single person was like just in it for the money, even though a good chunk of them were. Probably most of them were just there to get some money and fame. But that's a little bit about spiritualism. There are so many famous people from like this era that I think could be interesting to cover in the future. But that's all I have for you today.
Well, there you go. It's like the beginning. You can do your own little documentary. So
yeah. So definitely. It's a little true crimey with the fraud, all of the fraud.
No, well, only fraud, but okay.
Yeah, very true.
But yeah, there you go. Okay, cool. Well, that's good. Then you can definitely do like an ongoing series of.
Yeah. I want to see if I can find like something that wasn't debunked. Because every article I found, it was like blah, blah, blah. And then it was debunked.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, good luck. All right. All right, so I'm reading off a piece of paper because, again, your brother has my computer. So I apologize if you hear pages like flying around and things like that, or the ruffling of pages. But
it's old school.
Yeah, and originally I was going to say we should turn off the lights, and then you pointed at how am I going to read because...
Yeah, you can barely read with your glasses
on. That is true. Hey, look, you know, it is what it is. So buckle up.
I'm buckled.
Here we go. Kind of just sitting on the floor there. Okay. All right. And honestly, if this doesn't give you chills, then I don't know what will.
Lovely.
And if this was ever made into a movie, I personally would give it a 70s vibe. Like I would, you haven't seen When a Stranger Calls yet.
No.
The original. When I was reading the first synopsis, that's the first thing that came to my head. However, this actually takes place in the 80s, mid 80s.
Okay.
And it's kind of two parts, two chapters in a way, like Jaws-esque in a sense. Like there's this whole component there. However, one is much more violent than the other. And I'm torn discussing the more violent part in much detail because it should never have happened to begin with. And both parts, chapters have victims. Unfortunately, the suffering of some victims are much more than others.
Lovely. Okay.
So I'm going to kind of tell the story as if it was a movie, because it's how I would envision it as a movie, just okay. Because when I read the thing, I'm trying to remember where I even found the story. It was an anthology of just, you know, did you hear this or did you hear that? And I just went with that. And then I found an article and I read that article. And then I delved out on this one family from the first chapter, and then I found all these other articles, and they were all like exactly like me. They're like, "How is this not a movie?" So
wow. Okay, right. I'm very excited.
So there is actually a movie though that comes to mind after I read this. That at first I was like, "Oh my god, it's got to be this!" And I looked it up, and the guy who wrote it and directed it bears no mention of this. I couldn't find anything. There's some others that people talk about that I haven't seen. I don't want to name the movie because I don't want to spoil it.
Okay.
So, but if anybody's interested after the fact, they can DM us. We can tell them via DM. And I don't think you've seen it, so I don't want to tell you yet either.
Okay.
So, like I said, if I did more research, I found other people going, why isn't this a movie? But if it isn't a movie, it's, I think, the perfect campfire story. So this is something that, I mean, for you, you could like, this is a college dorm, like, you know.
I'll keep it in my back of my head.
All right. So for sources, actually, the first person I was going to talk about, this guy, it was a website called Parkaman or Parkaman, I don't know, .com. And the guy who wrote it, his name is Joe Turner, who was my first, and I was almost just going to take this part because I was like, this is incredible. But then Sword and Scale, had a write-up about it. And then Pachiba had, I think I used most of the Pachiba story, and I can't remember who wrote it, but she was, I mean, I don't have a bookmark, but I want to see what other things she's talked about, because her humor was very similar. I was like, oh my God, like, I get you, that kind of thing. So here we go. All right.
Yes.
It's 1986.
Okay.
Pepperell, Massachusetts.
Ooh.
That's, it's north, central Massachusetts, but north, almost the border. It's on the border with New Hampshire.
Okay. Okay.
The Andrews family mm-hmm. had suffered a tragedy, and I'm not sure if the names are real.
Okay.
Okay. So I don't know if they changed them or not, because I read someplace else, because I was reading somebody's comments. They were talking about that. Oh no, that they changed the names. So, but I don't know if that was real or not.
Okay.
The matriarch of the family had succumbed to cancer.
Oh.
And she was survived by her husband Brian, mm-hmm. and two daughters, Annie and Jessica. I think Annie was 15 when this all happens. She was 15 then. I don't know if her mother, if she was younger. And then Jessica was younger. I heard some said seven, some said, and if it's seven, then oh my God. I thought she may be closer to 10. Both girls were missing their mother, mourning their mother, but mm-hmm. Annie definitely took it harder. And again, maybe just because she was, you know, she was becoming a woman. She must have been close to her mom that way. And I think Jessica just didn't have as much time.
Right.
So she was pretty depressed. And her father was definitely concerned about her mental health. Mm-hmm. So the younger sister tried to cheer up any way she could. But of course, it would end up happening that they both would just be in tears, you know, after whatever happened.
Right.
And at school, teachers, students definitely noticed a change in Annie. Both in appearance and in demeanor and things like that, because Annie was very popular, many people were just attractive in general. Mm-hmm. Now, during this time, she was, I don't know if she had boyfriends before, but she was being courted heavily from this one kid. He was a 16-year-old boy, and I don't know if she had older people or older kids hitting on her or not, but she kind of liked it. And this kid's name was Daniel LaPlante, I don't know. And, but he wasn't, like, he courted her in a way of where he finally, like, he would start calling her at home. So it wasn't in your face at school kind of stuff. Okay. So the calls became frequent almost every day, to the point that she finally was like, you know, yeah, let's go out on a date.
Okay.
So she knew of him, like I said, but they weren't friends. I don't know if their circle were the same. And they go out on this date. And what was kind of interesting was she believed that it was her friends kind of set her up with him or gave her their number. But she didn't know how this whole thing started, right? And I don't think Jessica, well, she was not in the same school, but really knew of this kid either, okay? So it seemed to distract her from the daily mourning kind of thing. And her father was even kind of like, you know, whatever is happening, this is good. And she took more care in herself and that kind of thing. So going on the first date, it would be the last date.
Oh.
At this date, and I'm not sure if they went to like a restaurant, like or where they went. I mean, they were, again, 15 and 16. Who knows? I don't know if it was, they were talking. So maybe it was like a diner or something like that.
Back in the good old days, yeah, when these teenagers talked instead of texted.
Yeah, exactly.
And Snapchatted. And
well, I don't know. Maybe texting is better after you hear this. Oh. Because Daniel just kept pushing the conversation towards her mother about, all morbid things, like how it happened, like, ew, how was it at the end, like this, that.
That's a red flag. That's like five red flags.
And Annie was definitely feeling uncomfortable with the conversation where it was going. But, you know, he took it next a step further, like asking her, did she believe in the afterlife? Did she believe in ghosts? Ooh. And do you believe she could communicate? If her mother loved her so much, wouldn't she try to reach out?
Oh my God, so rude.
So she pretty much ended the date, then just like walked out and left, right?
Good.
And, you know, she went home and back into the depression, back into mm-hmm. her mother, this, that, and everything. However, that conversation with Daniel sparked something.
No, this is not good. Don't use a Ouija board.
No! So, she decided to see if she could speak to her mom. So she gets a hold of a Ouija board, and she decides to hold a seance. And she ropes Jessica.
No.
Into, so that's why if she was 7, I'm like, oh my God. So I don't, I'm hoping she was slightly older, but even I guess at 10 is not any better.
Well, I mean, how old were you when you were doing your Ouija board thing?
I was much older. We were in high school.
And would you have done it when you were younger?
No. No. Because I didn't have any interest. Like, if I was young, I don't know why I would have had interest. I mean, I had to see more movies before. So that kind of thing. So one evening, they gather to communicate with their mother. And her father worked, he had like a night shift, which again, perfectly falls into place here.
Yeah.
So he was definitely not home many evenings. And, you know, so they're doing this Ouija board thing. I don't know if they had candles and everything else, similar to your spiritualism thing. But nothing happens. Like, no signs, like, things, okay. Nothing like that go, right?
I feel like there's something still going to come of this, though.
So Annie, like, in a way, is now laughing it off. And actually, almost gets her out of a depression. Because she was just like, I can't believe I did this. And what am I thinking? And I'm good, an idiot. I mean, I'm a fool. So it was almost cathartic, I guess, in a way, right? So, day's done. Everything goes. And you're right. Like, almost immediately the next day, things change. All right?
No, don't use Ouija boards, you guys.
So, at first, Annie notices just things missing from the house. Like, her personal belongings. Like, things that her mother gave her are disappearing. So, what does she do? Blames Jessica. And she's blaming Jessica because she's like, you know, why would you take, I think it was a jealousy, you know, mom gave me that, this, that. And again, her demeanor, darker, right?
Right.
So then she's having these conversations. She's really getting angry. And Brian is kind of watching this and he's not thinking much about it, but he's definitely worrying about her mental state more now. I mean, the depression has gone now into something that's probably, you know, more, the fuse is shorter on her, and she's also getting kind of paranoid. So, but he's, you know, it's morning, right? And like I said, I don't know how much time has passed since she died, but we're getting into like January of 87 when this is all happening. So then all of a sudden furniture starts moving around.
Furniture.
Yeah. So, it's one of these things where they're never witnessing it. They're not, it's not seeing it move here or there, or whatever. But they would wake up the next morning, go downstairs, and things are moving around. And then it started to become a little bit more frequent where she would be in one room and then she'd go in the other room and it and then come back and it'd be gone.
That is so creepy. Especially because it's getting bolder.
Right. So Brian is now like, well, this can't be Jessica because she's not going to be able to move these things.
Like this chest of drawers.
Right. So he's starting to think that, okay, it's Annie and she, because he's not seeing any of this. Like he never notices it. I don't even know if he was home when these things happened, but he's like, hey, she's just trying to seek attention.
It's like her
she's
coping.
Right. It's just her only thing to kind of get through all this. And now Jessica's kind of like, Dad, I don't want to be home alone with Annie because I don't know where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens. Furniture, stuff like that. And now the next step. Bumps in the night.
No. Right?
So Annie can't sleep, of course, and she keeps waking up. She goes to her dad. It's like, Dad, can't you hear that? Do you hear that? And he's like, I hear nothing. You know, it doesn't take long before Jessica now is being awoken by Annie first to say, like, you know, can you stay with me? Can you do this? Like, you know, so she's getting freaked out. But then Jessica starts hearing the noises.
Oh, boy.
So after both of them complain, Brian is now kind of taking it seriously because I think even in his own head, he's like, I hope this is the case because I don't want to have two daughters that may, you know, can't handle what's going on, right? So Brian doesn't believe in the supernatural. He's not into any of that kind of stuff.
He will soon.
And he's just thinking that their minds are playing tricks on them, right? Mm-hmm. So he basically thinks that subconsciously they're causing or hearing what they want to hear. You know, right. No different than what you just talked about, which is crazy that you talk about spiritualism. But if you want, it's what you want to believe, right?
Yeah.
So he talks to doctors, he talks to therapists. And I don't think they have a lot of money, but he's trying to figure out what it could be. So...
Someone just walked by the window up there and I almost had a freaking heart attack. Oh, Jesus Christ.
But they test her, mm-hmm. and they don't find, I mean, they she's depressed, but they don't see anything mentally. Like, there's nothing, but I don't think they do CAT scans or anything like that kind of stuff, but they're like, she's fine. Yes, she may be depressed, but there's nothing that we can see cognitively that may be causing any of these things, which doesn't make Brian feel any better.
Oh, lovely.
So all that is now where they are in their world, and things begin to escalate quickly after that.
No.
All right. So one evening, the girls are home alone. Father's working, Brian's working late, and they all of a sudden hear this faint sound of banging coming from the basement.
Don't investigate.
And it's banging on a pipe. At least they thought it was a pipe. And then it started to grow into like a pummeling sound.
Oh my God.
Like, you know, think of the changeling, you know, like the banging kind of thing. And it's been now a few weeks that they've been going through all the stuff. And Annie's just like, my dad doesn't believe me. I got to figure this out. So she goes downstairs, goes to the kitchen, grabs a knife.
Okay.
Walks down the basement with Jessica in tow.
Oh my God.
Again. I'm like, what the heck?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go down there alone myself.
Fair. That's fair. So they go down to the basement, and as they go down, they turn the lights. And when they get down there, nothing. Like, can't see anything. Oh, my God. But then she screams because written on the wall in red.
Oh, no.
Says, I'm in your room.
Ew, ew.
Come find me.
Ew, leave that house now.
They burst out of the house, run to the neighbors, call their father, who's working wherever he's working, and is like, tells them what happens. He immediately calls the police. The police get there before he can even get there.
Okay.
Right? They go into the house, go downstairs, and they see it. Like, they see this written all in red, right? Father's there. They come out, and the cops come out, and they're like, it's ketchup.
Okay.
And Brian's like, what? And now he's like, what the? What are you guys doing? I mean, the police are like, come on, dude. Like, you know.
What? Is your kids playing a prank?
Exactly, right? So.
It's not the kids playing a prank.
So he's really, really angry. And he, you know, he starts scolding Annie, like, about the attention seeking. And like, you know, we got to do something. Like, I mean, I'm at a loss. And then he breaks down. Like, he's in tears. Oh. He's like, I'm trying to help, but I don't know what I can do. Like,
this is
what?
So sad.
So, of course, Annie gets in, Jessica gets in, group hug, everything. And they're just like, Dad, we're sorry. We're going to make it better. You know, we're not trying. And again, you know, I mean, he's lost a wife. So he's stressing through all this stuff, right? So he's just trying to figure out, I don't want to scar my children. They don't want to make this worse for him. And in the end, they're all kind of worried about Jessica because she's the youngest one going through all of this. So the girls tell him, like, look, we're going to do better. We're sorry. You know, we don't know. But in the back of their minds are like, there's something wrong here.
Right.
And they're between the two of them are like, all right, it's between us. We got to figure this out.
That's so brave.
So after that incident, everything stops. No banging, no moving of furniture, no missing of trinkets, no writing of ketchup or whatever it is.
That makes it seem like it was the girls, especially to the father now.
So we're going on almost 3-4 weeks here.
Wow.
And family is getting back together. Everybody's better. Like, even, you know, Annie's, I think, hanging with friends. She actually, she's like, friends are actually coming over, that kind of thing. So it's,
I could like see this as a movie too, like as you're describing it.
So I think, I'm assuming this got out to people, like what's been happening. And I don't know if their friends are like, oh, let's go to the creep house or whatever it is. But she's got a pretty, you know, a good friend in there. And I think also they wanted more people when the dad's not home to be in the house. Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, month goes by. the girls are now home alone. And like I said, Annie has a friend over as well. And, you know, they're just kicking in the kitchen area. This, I don't know if they're watching a movie or what they're doing.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, they hear knocking.
No.
Upstairs.
No.
So Annie grabs a knife from the kitchen again, and she's going to go upstairs to investigate.
Someone just walked by again.
It could be our little sign.
Yeah, maybe, but it's freaking me out, man.
So, of course, her friend and Jessica join her again in tow to go up the stairs. And as they walk up the stairs, before she can even get into the room, she gets to the hallway, and there's another message written on the wall.
Oh,
and
oh my God.
It looks like it's not ketchup. It looks like it's actually written in blood.
And they know the difference now.
And it says, "I'm back.
No.
Find me if you can."
Ew.
They immediately again.
And this time scream, the friend's there.
Yes. Scream, jump, like run out of the house. Go back to that neighbor who must be like, what the heck's going on here? And call their dad, right?
Yeah.
So they're telling their dad, and her dad is like, it's been a month. What's going on? But the friend's there and can hear the friend going, you know, Mr. Andrews.
Like, this is real. Like, I saw it myself.
So he's angry, but I think he's more angry than he's frightened. So he rushes home. He doesn't call the cops this time. He's like, I'm going. So he goes running into the house, and the three girls follow him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going up the stairs, and he sees the message on the wall. And then he runs into Annie's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And as he gets into the bedroom, he stops dead in his tracks.
Oh, God.
On her wall, he sees a message, which also looks like it's written in blood. And it says, marry me.
I just got chills.
However, that is not all. Next to the message is a figure in his wife's wedding dress.
No!
And the face is obscured with red makeup and is holding a hatchet.
Oh my God!
The figure swings at Brian. He narrowly misses, you know, getting hit. And he completely retreats out of the room with the girls right outside the room. And they run into another bedroom and lock the door.
Oh, my God.
Okay. They don't hear anything follow them. And somehow they climb out a window.
Oh, my God.
And then I think onto the lower and then jump down.
Mm-hmm.
And then they run to that neighbor.
Oh, this poor neighbor.
Call the police.
And the dad's with them, right?
Everybody's together.
Okay. Okay.
Call the police. Police now show up, and in a way, they're kind of like, what, you know, we've been there before, like, what's kind of going on? And I should actually step back. The one thing I forgot to say is that when they were in the room, there's one account that says they don't hear the figure come at them, but they hear the figure say, you're all going to die.
Ew.
But it was, I heard it in one place and I didn't see it in another place, but the police arrive. They find no one. I mean, nothing in the house.
That is just so
weird. But the writing's there.
And he got cut with a hatchet, right?
They narrowly missed him.
Narrowly
missed him, yeah. And actually, I don't say what it was, if it was blood. I think it was blood, because
where did they get the blood?
So the Andrews leave the home. Like, they're I don't know where they're staying or whatever it is, okay? So days pass.
Mm-hmm.
They return to the house, and I don't know if they're returning to get stuff or whatever it is, but it's a daylight, right? It's like bright daylight. And as they get into the house, it's Brian, Jessica, and Annie. They get into the driveway, and they look up, and they see the figure in the upstairs bedroom.
No!
Again, they call the police immediately. And the police now are like, okay, this is the third time. Like, what's going on? And when I was reading it, it was the fear in Brian's voice that caused them to be like, yeah, all right, we're coming. You know, they were skeptical, but they're like, we're coming. So the police get there and they search the house and go to that room. Nobody, walk around the house, nothing. Brian's the point. He's like, look, I don't know what to tell you, but there's something going on.
Right.
Can we do another sweep? So they're like, all right, fine. So now the police come, a couple more people come through. They're going through the house. And as they're walking through, they start to see like furniture had been moved.
Mm-hmm.
So there was like dust spots, this and that.
Right.
And they see this dresser. And then they move the dresser.
No.
And behind the dresser,
oh my God,
they find like a little door. They open that small door, and what do they find behind the door?
Oh my God, is there a person?
Daniel LaPlante.
Oh my God!
He had been living in the walls of the house for months. He made his way through a closet entry the first point.
Oh my God, I almost covered this story the last week.
They found a sleeping bag, clothes, food, and everything needed to live for months. He had been stalking Annie all that time.
Oh my God.
So, immediately taken to custody. Okay. Meets with doctors, psychiatric folks, everything else. Now, he gets charged with breaking and entering, stalking, malicious injury to property, assault, armed burglary, mm-hmm. right? So you think this would keep him, right, in custody.
Something well, tells me that it doesn't.
So he was a minor, and he gets placed into a juvenile facility. I don't know, because he's a minor, his age, all these other things, they decide to put him, they'll release him to his mother's custody. But while he was there in juvenile detention, mm-hmm. this came out. He told people that, you know, before he tormented the Andrews family, he would break in regularly into other people's homes. Similarly, like the creepy crawlies of the Manson family.
That's what it was reminding me of.
He would try to go in undetected, but he would rob people mostly, but he would then move furniture specifically to
freak them out.
To freak them out and to show that he'd been there for a longer period of time.
Right.
In October of 87, he's released. Again, his mom has custody of him. Mm-hmm. And he immediately goes back into robbing homes.
Of course.
Right? And in one of the breaking and entry or one of the break-ins, he ends up stealing two handguns.
Oh, okay? Boy.
Then, on December 1st, 1987, he commits the most heinous crime. A young, pregnant, I think, nursery school teacher, her name was Priscilla Gustafson, 33, was home with her two kids, William, 5, and Abigail, 8. Daniel raped Priscilla and then shot her multiple times, point blank, in the head. Oh, yeah. Then he drowned each kid in the bathroom, in two separate bathrooms.
Yeah.
Priscilla's husband, Andrew, would discover the bodies after he came home from work. Now, authorities immediately, I don't know why, but they thought it was him.
Right.
And they figured out later that why she was picked was because there was what they were, their houses weren't super close, but there was like a wooded path in between and a dirt path that combined their neighborhood to her neighborhood. So they think that he, because he was, you know, burglarizing a bunch of homes, that he may have cased it, but saw that. And they don't know why he went from where he did to murder at all.
Well, it seemed like he was pretty close with the
hatchet.
With Annie, yeah.
Yeah. So what he ended up, you know, so he's now gone again, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a manhunt. And what ends up happening for the police, they actually catch a break because a woman reports an attempted kidnapping, carjacking in a couple towns near there. So there's Pepperell, where the Andrews family lived. Then there was Townsend, and that's where he lived. And I think it was a couple towns for, like, I might have been Groton. It's this all out Route 2. If you go out Route 2 past Concord and Acton, kind of close to where Chris played soccer, that in Lancaster kind of thing, that big field area. So, of course, now police were on the, they went to go figure it out. He actually had, Daniel had broken into her home, forced her to go in the car, but she somehow escaped. And then another witness that saw her leave the car, or maybe there was a scuffle or whatever it was, and noticed it was Daniel because it was on the news. So they called police and they found him hiding in a dumpster behind some restaurant or something like that. He was charged. He was convicted of the triple murder, mm-hmm. life without parole.
Okay.
So for years showed no remorse at all about any of the murders or anything like that. And then LaPlante forever tried to get his conviction overturned, the life without parole overturned, because he was saying, hey, I was a minor. This should never have been the case. I should be able to have 30 years.
You murdered three people.
Yeah, because it should have been life 30 years. After 30 years, you could be up for parole. So he was trying to fight for that and everything like that. So that went on for years. And in 2014, Andrew Gustafson, her husband, He died while LaPlante was still appealing in this process. But in 2017, they basically said, no, you're going to stay in jail. And if you want to try to appeal again, you can appeal at 30 years when, you know, you've served that. And we'll talk about it then. But right now, that ain't happening. And he finally, after that all happened, said he was really sorry for all the harm. I mean, everybody else is gone, all from the family and everything like that. But I don't know if that means he can try it again in 30, but I think he's done. I think he's going to be in jail. I mean, there's more to him on how he was brought up, and he was definitely abused when he was a kid and all these other things. But I don't even want to go into it with him. Like, I feel like it's not about him at all. Right. It's about this, but the living in the walls and doing all the things he did, and oh my God. But yeah, like I said, there's a movie that when I read this, I was like, holy cow. But that would be a really good movie. The moment I read that part about the living in the walls and stuff, and some others embellished, some other stories were saying, like, you know, the family got tied up and all sorts of stuff, but I couldn't find corroborating.
Yeah. When I was looking for true crime, I almost picked that one. Yeah. Because I was like, oh my God, that's insane.
But there you go.
Wow.
So it was true crime. I just had to keep that story of the...
I like the way you told it, though.
Sorry, but it definitely...
We both kind of edged the line with paranormal and true crime this week.
Absolutely. So yeah, fun fact time.
Yes.
All right. Yeah.
Oh my God. All right. So... I have three fun facts for you from the Dodo, we love the Dodo. We watch their videos on YouTube all the time.
We absolutely do.
And they're about animals, and they're very happy, so that can take our minds off of
good.
That horribly depressing and like scary story that you just did.
That's right. You should check your closets for any like little egresses into your walls and things, if I were you.
Wow. Look at you, on your phone, disrupting our podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
I see how it is. Okay, number one. The fingerprints of koalas are so indistinguishable from humans that they have, on occasion, been confused at a crime scene. Assuming in Australia. Because I guess koalas were there and...
They weren't part of the partner or something like that? You go over there, touch all that stuff.
Okay. Yeah, you touch that and I'm going to commit the crime.
Exactly.
Number two, slugs have four noses.
Hmm.
So they didn't even have anything else there, but just...
Interesting. I didn't even know they had noses. I thought like tentacles would be everything.
But. Oh, yeah, you're right. Very, very strange. And then lastly, you can hypnotize a frog by placing it on its back and gently stroking its stomach.
I didn't know that, but like, it makes sense. And I feel like there's other, like with sharks, you know,
talk
about that kind of thing. And
I wonder what, like, why one would need to hypnotize a frog.
Good question. That's a good question.
And like how that was discovered.
Yeah, no, I wonder. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that's my question about that.
All right, yeah, there you go.
But yeah, those are from the Dodo, so thank you for those very interesting fun facts. If you would like to send in your own fun facts, you can do that at our Gmail, which is everythinginpodcast@gmail.com. If you have story suggestions or stories that you've experienced, please send those there too. We'd love to read them and maybe even put them on the podcast.
Yeah.
So definitely do that. You can also submit that to our website, which is everythingpodcast.weebly.com. Lots of fun stuff on there, but, you know, just a fun place to submit. We are on social media. Our Instagram is @everythinginpodcast. Our Twitter is @between_podcast. And we have a Facebook group and page, both by the name of Everything In Between Podcast. So check us out there. We post when new episodes come out, giveaways if we do those, pictures from our stories. So if you want to see some of that cheesecloth and egg white mixture, definitely check there. So that's where we post that. If you're listening on a platform that allows you to do so, please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe. It's very helpful and gives us a nice ego boost.
Do you have a song for this week?
Not yet. Do you have one?
I think I have one for you.
Yes.
I can.
Your songs are always so
You want me to say it or you want to wait?
No, say it.
Spirit in the Night.
Wait, I don't know that song.
Springsteen, you know it.
Okay.
You do know it.
I'm sure I will know it.
You definitely know it.
Okay.
you do.
Maybe I don't know the title, but
yeah, when you hear it, yeah.
Okay. Good. I'm excited. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh yes.
Spotify.
We pick a song to represent our stories each week. As you know now, clearly. And we've compiled those songs in a playlist on Spotify called The Soundtrack In Between. So check that out. Put it on shuffle if you want. Give it a listen. It's a good mix. And we'll probably have some Bruce Springsteen on it. It already has.
Sure, we could use it for both of ours when I think about it.
Spirit of the Night times two. But I think that is it.
I do have one thing.
Oh, you do?
So the movie I was saying that we gotta watch... Extraordinary.
Oh yeah.
So if you folks haven't seen it,
I've only seen that trailer once.
No, you've seen it one time. We've watched it multiple times.
One time. I was not there for those other times.
It was if you get a chance, it's one of those, you know, it's in theater, well, would have been in theaters, so they released it and you can rent it. It's on Apple. It's probably been all places to rent. But I think it takes place in Ireland and it's with a clairvoyant and a medium, because I think that's what she can, you know, basically she can see dead people. There's a bunch of people in it and it just looks really, really well done. So
are we going to watch it tonight?
I'm still thinking, as much as I hate it, I might have to watch Rise of Skywalker because it came out today. So just to see it a second time. We'll see it soon. We'll see it before we record the next time so we can talk about it. But if other folks see it, please let us know what you think.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. So yeah, that's it. Sorry. I wrapped that up because you said I was going to forget and I didn't.
Oh, well, I forgot. So
yeah, well, there you go.
There's no surprise there. Anyway, that's about it. So I guess until next week.
Till next week.
Bye.
Bye.